Up next on KSCO, the Dr. Future Show.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Dr. Future Show with me.
What happened?
There goes the signal. Are we back?
Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
Boy, weird world, huh?
You know, it's funny. I just had a story on sunspots.
We'll
get into that in a minute. Okay. Hey, folks, welcome to the Dr. Future Show.
Huh?
Yeah, we're back to the top of the hour here. We had a slight little
glitch
in the
some kind of little audio malfunction.
Yes.
Yes, probably in our audio music.
But with all the interesting things going on these days, it's no wonder. And I'm going to share with some of you some of the more amazing things that have been happening this week. I know there's some really dark stuff happening, like the floods in Denver. It's very much a tragedy,
and
our hearts are with those people.
The shooting in Virginia.
Yes, and the shooting and the state of mental health in our country.
Mental health problems everywhere, yeah.
So I have a few stories that I think add a little light to that topic.
Yeah, really, folks, that's our only choice. The future has got to be brighter because, boy, we need to dig ourselves out here a bit.
And it really starts with us in talk radio, because if we can imagine it, it's a step towards creating it.
That's right. That's what humans do. They imagine and then they create. So let's do some of that. What? Is that your microphone? Are we moving too much?
Maybe that information shouldn't have been out there just yet.
Oh, right. The world is not ready for any good news, right?
Well, no. Mostly good. Every so often,
stress.
A little editing. It's the way I look at it.
All right. Well, let's tell people today, folks, you've got me, Sun Lundell, and Al Lundell, Dr. Future, and we are going to be bringing you all these really fascinating stories. And if you find that you have something to add to what we're saying and want to comment on it, please do chime in here at KSCO. We love to hear from you. And the number here is 831-479-1080, the KSCO call number. Okay, so yeah, let's start at the top here.
Okay. As many of you may have heard from USA Today or Newsweek, second private spacecraft is set for the space station run right now. There's a launch that's the beginning of a competition in the space business. This is about sending packages to outer space. It's not quite as easy as UPS or FedEx at this point, but if all goes well on Wednesday, there's a privately owned robotic spaceship called the Cygnus. It'll blast off from Wallops Island, Virginia, to deliver cargo to NASA's astronauts who are up in the ISS, the International Space Station. Now, this is a fairly new beginnings for private industry to get into the space business. This will mark really the beginning of competition in that, because the only company, the private company, to launch before this was SpaceX.
That's right.
With Elon Musk.
Elon Musk sent the Dragon up to the International Space Station not once but twice, delivering cargo to the people up there.
Right? Exactly, yeah.
So now Cygnus is the next flying bird to get in the air to go to the space station. Cygnus being, of course, the swan in the myth of Zeus and Leda, and also the constellation in the middle of the Milky Way.
Oh, yeah. Have you dug into this, the mythology of Cygnus?
I did. I looked up Cygnus just for this article, and you can see Cygnus in the night sky. It happens to embody the Northern Cross and some of the brightest stars in the Milky Way. So Cygnus is joining Dragon in the new space race.
Developed by
vehicles who can leave the planet.
Orbital Sciences Corporation.
Okay.
Orbital Sciences Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
This is real life sci-fi, folks.
That's
so
right.
Keep an eye on OSC.
In the early days of spacefaring civilization, as we try to lift off the planet.
It's an interesting story because I'm just tuning into more of the details myself. OSC has got a lot of connections with big industry and government, and yet they're private. While SpaceX is kind of the newcomer on the block, the one that's out of the West Coast here and much more on the edge of doing everything themselves without deep pockets behind them. So Cygnus has deep pockets behind it, from my understanding. So they're serious contenders.
Mm-hmm. Suffice to say that there are two private space companies who are actually delivering supplies to the International Space Station, and one of them sets off today.
That's it. A closer to home in the Silicon Valley tech world, Twitter is about to go IPO.
Whoa. All right.
So you'll be able to invest
News
in
hounds.
Twitter.
Be alerted.
Yeah. The industry is all a flutter or a twittering about it. It's kind of exciting because there's been a billion messages every 2.5 days now on Twitter. It's really become a significant part of our species' nervous system, if you will.
Yeah, definitely the chat channel.
Yeah. One of the posts I put up for you are the 23 most key moments in the history of tweets and Twitter.
I think this is so great. Mm-hmm. I'm curious how many of our listeners remember all these great moments because we covered a lot of them on this show. Being futurists and being so interested in the way that our culture is embracing our new communication technology and doing things with it that we've never done before.
Well, let's take a look at news, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. January 2009. Remember when that U.S. Airways plane with 155 people did that miraculous emergency landing in the Hudson River?
Oh, yes.
In New York?
The epic plane river landing with no casualties.
After striking a bird during takeoff. Remember that?
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Well, one of the most famous
hero pilot.
Twitters was that event, that famous photo that you probably in all your minds of passengers waiting on the plane's wing to be rescued.
Yeah, right. In the middle of New York, in the river, on a plane boat.
And that came from a tweet. So that cemented Twitter's status as a real-time news gathering tool.
Right.
By anybody.
It's just great for that, to broadcast your latest photograph of whatever you're seeing to your followers. And if your followers think it's interesting, then they send it out to their followers. And next thing you know, we have a trending topic.
Yeah. And then April 2009, that's when Ashton Kutcher narrowly outpaced the CNN to become the first Twitter user with 1 million followers.
A million. The power of the internet. Mm-hmm. The cult of personality takes over the brand, the news brand.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
They're bigger than CNN, you know, for a celebrity.
Social networking works better than advertising.
People pay attention to celebrities in our culture.
Well, people would much rather have a personal relationship than be told what to do by some faceless brand, right? So, Twitter is about people.
Well, when you stop and think about it, though, CNN, you usually think in particular people on CNN that you have an affinity with, that you listen to and you believe in, like your housemate Mark. And
yeah, sure. If you go back to the earlier era and when Ted Turner created CNN to be the on-the-spot 24-hour news channel reporting from the front in a way that news had never been covered
before. So is that really personality-driven then, too?
I think it was the generation before Twitter. I think it is interesting that CNN happens to be the one that Ashton Kutcher overtook.
Yeah. Now, it is also interesting that it makes it possible for anyone to get a following without having to go the traditional route of developing a cult of personality. You could suddenly become a personality at 40 or 50 if you decided to come out of whatever closet you're in.
Well, I think if you're interesting and you're cultivating your audience and you're giving them things that they value, then they'll follow you. We ourselves are barely using Twitter because Twitter is really for people who are texting to their followers.
And one-to-many transmission. So if you want to say something to a lot of people at once, like maybe you have some information about weather or earthquakes or horticulture, you can do that, right? You just develop your following. And that's what's been happening.
Yeah, and the thing is that if you are a Twitter user, you are very interested in broadcasting to your following. And it's just sort of a fun habit.
They don't have to respond to you each time.
Right.
It's like a one-to-many, just like television and radio, as it is now. Everyone gets it. But it's more targeted. I guess you're just getting people who subscribe to your feed.
Yeah, it's more targeted. It's more specific to who you are. Yeah. And the things that you broadcast go out there and they get interspersed with whatever other things your followers are following. So it's really a new kind of communication it's really changed the way that the world communicates with itself.
Another example of this, Twitter, as well as Facebook, I might add, played a key role in the Arab Spring uprisings starting in January of 2011. And that's in Tunisia, in Egypt, Libya, now Syria.
Yeah.
Social networking to message each other.
And that very spring uprising probably led to a lot of the countries who then removed themselves from the internet.
Oh, here's the key thing here. It allowed people to organize protests, for example.
peacefully.
So Twitter was a very useful organizational tool.
Yeah, so we've moved away from the era where bullies can just brutalize crowds of peaceful protesters without the world finding out, because everyone has a personal communication device, and many of those people are connected to large networks of people who care about what they're
seeing. And get their information out right away.
That's right.
That's why I like to think of this more as a nervous system.
Oh, right? So it's like the thing happens and the nervous system
takes it and sends it out to where it needs to go.
And tells the brain, which is distributed. Distributed brain of humanity.
The species brain is not one place. It's a distributed thing. Mm-hmm. Unless there's something in the center of the earth I don't know about.
We're all a part of it. Even you.
Yeah. That's so true.
Yes, the Twitter universe. Things have really improved.
Oh, okay. Just to give you how strange Twitter can be, too. Remember Representative Tony Weiner? Well, he resigned in disgrace over this whole Twitter thing. Anyway, let's go on to another topic. I think our audience gets the point. This is the Dr. Future Show. This is Al Lundell, Dr. Future, Mrs. Future. See you after the break. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Oh, one final thing on the whole tweet thing. In case you feel like you missed any of these famous tweets or even less famous tweets, the Library of Congress has announced, as of April of 2010, that they have plans to archive every public tweet.
And there's a link for that right here.
There's a link for that
article.
That's right.
Also, I have a little trivia question for you. Anybody who goes to this article can find out and call in. Who has the record of the most shared tweet ever? I bet the listeners of this station will be shocked to find out. So, anyway, feel free to call in. 831-479-1080 if you find this information.
What's the question again?
Who has the record for the most shared tweet ever?
Shared tweet.
Shared tweet, yes. The tweet that was shared by the most followers. 800,000 people shared this particular tweet, and it's a picture.
And they passed it on.
Great event, yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. A passed on picture.
Yes. For other interesting items in the future news.
Ah, yes. You know, one of our great biologists, E.O. Wilson, has been pursuing a vision, a dream, that she feels is really important for all of us to know about. First of all, E.O. Wilson is a very well-known American biologist, researcher, theorist, naturalist. His specialty is myrmecology, the study of ants. He's done a lot of books on ants and insects of various sorts. I think ants and bees are two of his favorite topics. And he's known as the father of sociobiology, as he studies not just the biochemistry of the ants, but their behavior and what they do and how they do it, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And he's a good connection with Ms. Costa on Friday.
Yeah, Rebecca Costa, I think, tells us he's her mentor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You're a big fan. He wrote a book you're very fond of called Superorganism.
Superorganism, which looks at the way, especially insects like ants and bees, organize collectively and how that all works.
And so when you get into the E.O. Wilson world, you really begin to see the whole ecosystem of the Earth in a very connected way as a big social system with lots of species, with their own wonderful behaviors and how they are related to each other.
Yes, yes, and how they interact with each other, which is hardly known.
Yeah.
Now, we tend to be very species-centric.
Us
right?
Humans.
99.9% of what we pay attention to is about the hairless monkey world of humanity. And that's it. Yeah, that's all of reality for most of us because it's so all-consuming. Let's be fair about it. It is a very consuming environment to be in here on the West Coast in California and having so much at our fingertips. But what E.O. Wilson has put out is a vision for creating a resource or a knowledge of all life and free access to all the world's knowledge about life. The online free internet of species, you know, and really understanding all the other species on the planet and how they relate to each other, what we know about them, and allow it to be contributed to by many, 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 many people. It's a many-to-one sourcing of a kind of encyclopedia of life itself.
Yes, and when he brought this up at TED, he was just emphatic about the fact that in the last 300 years, millions of species have been studied and identified, and there is no central repository for information about all of this knowledge. His dream was to create a resource for the world where knowledgeable people could post all of the information that they wanted to about their specialized field of knowledge.
It's vast. I mean, 20,000 new species are now being discovered every year. 20,000 new species. I don't know how many are going extinct, but you know, but probably more new ones are forming than are going extinct.
Yeah, and so this is really kind of a specialized Wikipedia where instead of just having your thumbnail of information about a subject, this is actually meant to be a resource by professional scientists. It's meant to be peer-reviewed. It's meant to be a definitive resource for people who want to know what's going on with any species of life on the planet.
It's called the Encyclopedia of Life. I have a link to it on our links page.
Yes, that's EOL.org. And you can become a member and start immersing yourself.
EOL. So they've got Encyclopedia of Life as .org. Now, that's pretty primal, pretty basic.
Yeah, that's easy to remember.
Yeah, well, I guess life is what invented primal to begin with.
There you go.
Speaking of interesting, like, we are learning a lot about the other species around us. And one of them has been the mosquito. One thing us hairless monkeys like to do is deal with things that bother us. And mosquitoes bother us.
That seems to be something most hairless monkeys feel, is that why are there mosquitoes? What use are mosquitoes? And what can we do about them?
Yeah. The breakthrough lately with mosquitoes is that there is a naturally occurring substance found in human skin that, if harvested, can render people invisible to the insects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
an invisibility potion.
Our last show, we were talking about how mosquitoes seem to tune into our smell.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, they detect our smell.
That's right.
That's right. And
so
this,
now we've got some scientists who are learning how to prevent the mosquitoes from smelling us.
Yeah. Well, they think so. They think that they've detected how those mosquitoes tune into us. And it's nasty because they can carry malaria. It killed 660,000 people in 2010. Fortunately, not too much in our country, but buzz off. You know, those mosquitoes here, just taking your blood is no fun.
Yeah. There are so many mosquito stories. The Panama Canal could not be built for the first 10 years because of mosquitoes. They had to eradicate the mosquitoes before they could finish the Panama Canal. And that's just one of many, many stories about how mosquitoes are a big obstacle to human design on the planet.
So here's the key here. If a mosquito can't smell you, if it can't sense that dinner is ready, there will be no buzzing, no landing, and no bite. That's the bottom line. It's long been known that some people are more attractive to mosquitoes than others. But this latest research team has found that there is a group of chemical components that we naturally secrete that mask human smell from our blood-sucking insect friends. So it's a masking approach. Some people have more of this than others.
The researcher team is led by Dr. Bernier, who conducted this experiment to try and figure out which of the hundreds of components on human skin.
Right. It's not simple. Hundreds of compounds make up our smell.
Right. They started experimenting. They put all kinds of compounds into the classic mosquito cage where in the old Off commercials, you would put your hand into the cage and watch all
how
the mosquitoes
landed.
Land, right? Well, in this case, our researchers were looking at the substances that the mosquitoes did not care about. So they started studying the opposite of what attracts mosquitoes and went into how can we hide from the mosquitoes so that we don't have to worry about it.
Right. Just invisibility. Yeah.
Right.
Brilliant.
Yes. Invisibility is very popular now in this species. You don't have to fight if you can just hide.
I know, but with all this new technology and surveillance awareness, how can you hide anymore?
How can you hide with surveillance technologies, Dr. Future? Do you have an answer?
Well, I think you've got to look at what you need to hide and make those decisions on a issue-by-issue basis.
Oh, so for instance, hiding data is one thing. Hiding buildings is something different. Hiding from your mother-in-law is something
totally. Everything is unique and unqualifiably different.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing, is that we have to be on our toes. We can't just have a rule that applies to everything. Things are changing very rapidly right now.
I see.
So the whole idea of how to create rules that can evolve needs to be thought about. You know, the basic infrastructure of how society evolves. That's a big topic. Let's just take them one story at a time.
Well, I thought in terms of visibility, you might want to cover the other invisibility story that you have on the slate today.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, I did get your cue there. That about the buildings, right?
Yes.
That is the world's first invisible skyscraper is being planned. Guess where?
Someplace where they like to hide skyscrapers.
South Korea. I guess they don't want the North Koreans to hit it with their missiles or something.
I see.
Yeah.
So, but they're only hiding one building. I mean,
it's better than none. You know, at least one building will survive if it's invisible. Okay, this is how it works. You know, it reminds me of a 1962 Tom Swift novel. What it is about is a way of making a skyscraper invisible, not just temporarily like a magician might do, but more like permanently, or at least at night, right? I think the invisibility works best at night. Essentially, what they've done is they've taken the technology of LEDs and micro cameras, combined them to cover the entire surface of the skyscraper with micro LEDs and cameras, so that what's recorded on one side is projected on the other side of the building in real time. So you take a picture of, say, the sunset on one side, and you project the sunset on the other side, and the building reflects the sunset. It becomes the sunset. It becomes dark. It's even better, because all you do is reflecting a bunch of lights.
I see. So they're basically doing a gimmick to hide a building.
Using cameras. Cameras and screens.
Yes.
And LED screens are interesting because they can now become as bright as sunlight. So if you start matching sunlight and start playing with variables that allow the brain to tell the difference between synthetic and real light, you start blending that realm, they can essentially become invisible, optically invisible.
This is very interesting. So do you think in South Korea that they're just testing out this off-the-shelf technology because they're already doing it with, say, I don't know, flying machines?
I think it's because they're really creative down there. From what I can see, South Korea's led the charge on massive bandwidth available to all. They have huge amounts of bandwidth for their people. I think this increases their intelligence and ability to create amazing, innovative things.
Right. And so just the fact that they're dealing with this incredible literacy in this new medium of LEDs and communication technology and data transfer and mapping images from one side of a building to another.
Yeah.
They're having fun inventing these things.
Absolutely. They're taking it outside of the normal paradigms. People think of cameras, they think of vacations, they think of movies, they think of surveillance. But there's far more uses for cameras than that.
Invisibility sounds way more fun than surveillance.
Yeah. Do not throw the baby out with the bathwater here. You know, this is nature has billions of eyeballs every second alive around us for a reason.
Right. There you go. So we're in the process of activating those billions of eyeballs for our computerized brain.
That's just one component.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all alive.
What other components come to mind when you think about this one invisible building? What other things are going to be part of it?
Well, the LED technology, for example, the reflections, the screen technology, right? So you have the camera side and you have the screen side. They're both worlds in and of themselves. We saw last week some of the new 3D laptops or the 3D tablets, right? Pretty interesting.
Yeah, they really put a whole little world inside your hand,
screen. Display technology is evolving rapidly right now. It's going to go 3D. It's going to get more and more realistic. And there's a point where it blends with a reality. And now that's what augmented reality is all about, too.
And transporter reality, too.
Okay, well, let's start with augmented. You're basically with, the smart glasses of the near future. You'll have a layer where, you know, we have what we have today, which is usually a little bit of shading, you know, a little bit of sunshade. and maybe a little tweaking of the colors. Sometimes I like a brown sunshade. Sometimes I like more of a greenish, you know, depending on my mood or what I need. Gold some days, you know, it's nice to have different sunglasses. To be able to change that on the fly, you're going to see a Kickstarter project probably along those lines pretty soon.
Now, a Kickstarter project to do what?
To create sunglasses that can change shade.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Stuff like that. That's just the beginning, because the augmented reality is where it not just can change color, but it makes everything in your field of view clickable.
Oh.
Is that some other channel bleeding into our reality
yes,
here?
Yes, yes, yes. There's a little bit of an issue with our channels today.
Okay.
We are about to go to a break. Keep going here. I need a little more time.
Okay, so... So augmented reality makes everything clickable and more. It allows you to associate information with various places in space-time. You could have virtual tours of things where things aren't really there, but they are there by GPS in cyberspace. So when you visit a certain location, you'll be able to see a monument without having to build one in physical space. I think that's catching on.
Uh-huh.
So that's another layer that's unfolding with this technology.
All right, augmented reality.
Yeah, so and then there's Google Glass.
Visibility to extra layers of reality.
Right, right.
All with enhanced computerized tools.
That's right.
All right, well, we'll be back with more Dr. Future News after the break here, folks. Stay tuned, KSEO 1080.
Yes, Todd Rundgren. He was one of the first rock stars I got to know.
Really?
Yeah, back when I was an editor at Byte Magazine.
He's always seemed to be pretty future-minded for celebrity personality.
He was doing a one-man show with Amigas, using Amigas to run different instruments.
Right.
Pretty cool. Yeah. He's a fun guy. He used to live in...
69 Sunshine Court.
Yeah, that's right. You remember.
I remember. I met you there.
Oh, you met me there. Oh.
We had one of our early dates there. Yeah, exactly.
69 Sunshine. Yeah, I remember that.
Easy to remember.
Sausalito.
Very good.
The automotive world is abuzz right now with the announcement of General Motors developing a car to rival Tesla.
You mean the Tesla vehicle, not Tesla car. The scientist.
No. He's been gone for a while.
Right.
Him and Edison, they wrestled. But no, today it's GM versus Tesla.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're developing a car that will go 200 miles on a charge, and GM says they think they can bring it in for about $30,000.
Ooh, that will definitely give the Tesla a run for the money.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Although... Of course, the GM cars probably won't be able to charge free at the Tesla electric charge stations.
And they probably won't have the autonomous vehicle control systems that Tesla is evolving right now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, do you talk about that? I thought Teslas were known to have skipped a little bit of the controls, at least for traffic safety, compared to a lot of other luxury vehicles.
Well, so thought analysts, but a scouring of their help wanted ads or the kind of people they're hiring suggests that Tesla is actually looking for someone who's knowledgeable about autonomous vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
They're heading in the direction of autonomy for their future car.
I see. So they want to be electric, and they don't want to have to rely on drivers.
Yeah, let me pull up the report here.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, this is in The Verge. Tesla Motors is getting serious about building self-driving cars. The electric automaker has posted a job opening for an advanced driver assistance systems control engineer. I say then that will help the company develop technology for fully autonomous vehicles. It says they're looking for an engineer that, quote, will be responsible for developing vehicle-level decision-making and lateral and longitudinal control strategies for Tesla's effort to pioneer fully automated driving, close quote.
Oh, boy.
Fully automated driving.
Yeah, so he's going to jump in with Google there.
They also want these features not just for future electric cars, but they want to retrofit such systems onto its Model S sedan.
Mm-hmm.
That's their $50,000 car.
All right. Well, I guess these big auto manufacturers are looking for the cars of the future. We do have a lot of states that are allowing people to drive autonomous vehicles as they come into existence.
Yeah, it's starting to happen. I think 3 states, Florida, California, and Nevada.
Yeah.
Except you need to have a registered driver, human, behind the wheel.
Yes.
Even when they're on automatic mode.
Right.
We'll see how long that lasts.
Isn't that interesting? We're taking the autonomous car and insisting that they keep a human around for safety.
Well, I guess the human could keep himself busy.
Right. Well, if the human has to grab the wheel because the autonomous car is messing up, I'll tell you, it's going to have to be pretty messed up.
Yeah, I know. Important legal questions must be answered, like, should the driver of an autonomous vehicle be allowed to text?
That's true. Well, I guess at that point, they're a passenger, right?
So. Yes. Well, you see, that would be the legal thing there. They're kind of not a passenger. They're not a driver. They're in the netherworlds.
Right. It's like a co-pilot. They're the autonomous co-pilot.
Yeah. Are co-pilots allowed to text? No. Or they're just the pilot. What are the rules in the airline industry around those lines?
I wonder.
Anybody know the answer to that? So anyway, the legality of self-driving cars is going to be quite amusing to watch that evolve.
Okay. Google is saying it expects its system to be ready in the next 3 to 5 years for its own autonomous vehicles.
Yeah. And now, it makes you wonder, like, if Google and Tesla teamed up on this, things could speed up if they got along. It's all about the
Google's the engineers software. So if they teamed up, I imagine Google will give its software to any of the manufacturers that are trying to create autonomous vehicles.
Yeah. Right? And the fact that Tesla's looking for somebody new to pioneer it, they need their Steve Jobs. They need their leader in autonomy thinking.
Right. Outside the box.
Yeah, and I think the Google guys got a Stanford team that became part of their efforts.
Right. The people who are winning the autonomous vehicle races.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting world. We'll keep a toe in that water just to see what's next.
Very interesting.
Well, you see, part of the thing is that there has been an evolution in autonomy in high-end cars for some time, in other cars besides the Tesla. It's an industry where there's automatic parking capability. There's smart cruise control.
Collision avoidance.
Collision avoidance systems. Right, right.
There's technologies that will pass someone and get in the right lane for you.
Exactly. All these things are coming in piecemeal, one little special feature set after another.
Oh, there's the Volvo experiment where they have the lead car who then is making the decisions, but there's a bunch of radio controls for the follower cars that can then all be autonomous.
Yeah, the Volvo approach is imagine a train, only it's a train of your cars, and there's a front lead car or truck with about 20 cars behind it, and they all travel in. That's really great for long-distance interstate traveling, I would say. Mm-hmm. And then the cars break off as they come to their various destinations, to the various exits off the freeway.
Yeah.
It kind of makes sense under certain conditions. Everybody's thinking up different aspects of this. It's fascinating. So Tesla's going to enter the game now, and that makes two Bay Area leaders in the autonomy vehicle world, or two Bay Area contenders, Tesla soon, and, of course, Google.
Great. Well, I hope Silicon Valley is ready to let go of the steering wheel.
At some point, there's going to be some contention between autonomous vehicles and human drivers. We're going to see some interesting scenarios.
Can you imagine them fighting over control? No, I want to drive. I'm sorry. You are not authorized.
I'm sorry. You're too asleep.
That's right. You must pass a drunk test before I will allow you personal control of this autonomous vehicle.
Well, drunkenness, of course. But, I mean, they'll pay attention to subtle details. I see you're a little depressed right now. Now, if you take your medication, I'll let you drive.
That's funny. Yeah, they have this kind of solution for people who lose their keys, right?
Yeah,
you have to talk your car into letting you in if you don't have your key.
Yeah, well, that's the whole thing. You know, we're talking about what to do about the Mano who killed all those people in Washington, D.C., and mental health that Ethan was speaking about in the show before this. Uh-huh. The obvious direction where this is all going is personalized medicine.
Personalized medicine.
Yeah, everyone gets exactly what they need. They have enough attention paid to them on psychological as well as physiological levels to get better health care.
That's interesting. So your mind leaps from the idea of autonomous vehicles to technologies that are so personal that they just take over all kinds of normal habits for you.
Well, they know more about you than your doctor possibly could have the time for.
If you participate.
Yeah, if you pay. Them the info. Like, there's a lot of smart apps for your phone, a lot of apps for your phone now, that will allow you to be able to track your heart rate, blood pressure, your brainwave activity. There's a lot of biofeedback elements. Then all these will feed into your personal profile of who you are and how you respond to various drugs or various stimuli. They might know if you're agoraphobic, for example. All this information is organized. I think it will be organized into some form of personalized AI, kind of like Siri on your iPhone, except that it will be extremely knowledgeable of you and your health and your awareness, and will offer you information that will facilitate that. And initially it'll be information, but it will also include other forms of stimulation that your computer can provide you.
Now, do you have any links about this in this?
Yeah, website? I mean, we cover this all the time. Personalized medicine would be the overall topic, and you'll see a lot of stuff. Every week we'll try to present something else in the evolving personalized medicine world. I think something that we all would really like to see that's coming out soon is this new version of The Wizard of Oz.
Yes.
You heard about
that? The Wizard of Oz, a classic film. Yeah, tell us about 3D Wizard of Oz.
It's one of the most enduring cinematic achievements so far. And what Warner Brothers and the folks at IMAX have done, they've pulled out all the stops and they've restored it in 3D and increased its resolution for IMAX. Starting September 20th, you can see firsthand just how evolved this process is. They extruded things. They created 3D out of it. They took individual scenes and literally added a dimension of depth to them, and using untold numbers of computers and about 1,000 people to be able to create this.
And they went back to the original Technicolor color separations and used those color separations to generate the 3D effects. The original color film is now turning into a very important 3D film.
Yeah. Yes. We have a link up there for you so you can watch behind the scenes of how they did this. Fascinating.
Uh-huh. So 3D Wizard of Oz.
Yeah. IMAX 3D restoration. Pretty amazing. Very quickly, we're going to see how even old videos, if they recorded something interesting, they can be restored and brought into a more grandiose form today. There's some new software that I also put a link to. Jaw-dropping software that makes 3D models from any photograph. So if you have a picture of a 19th century telescope, you run the software and you can extrude it into a three-dimensional model.
Wow.
Yeah, very easily. It was debuted at SIGGRAPH this year.
Mm-hmm. So any old photograph can be scanned into a 3D
Well,
image.
If there's an object in there. Mm-hmm. That is within certain parameters, telescopes and cylinders and cups and saucers, and these sorts of things are easily extruded into three-dimensional objects. And this allows you to create 3D worlds with those objects in them. It's kind of exciting. Of course, then if you get the 3D printers, then you can print out those objects and actually have those Eustachian plates from 18th.
And if you have the right kind of LED screen, you can make those 3D objects invisible.
Yes, you can start doing 3D magic, 3D magic act. Hey, watch me make things appear and look real. No more pixelation. It's kind of interesting timing because the technology is getting so sophisticated that we're having multi-million dollar effects at our fingertips by being home amateur media makers.
Right?
That's just remarkable. Now, it's just a question of skill sets and creativity of what you do with these tools to make something as amazing as anything you might see out of Hollywood.
Absolutely. Really fun. So 3D Wizard of Oz and invisible buildings. The future is going to be quite strange, I think.
Personalized medicine. Let's not forget that.
Oh, well, I hope we can do some more on personalized medicine after the break. Here we are at the end of the first hour of the Dr. Future Show here on KSCO 1080, Santa Cruz, San Jose, Salinas, and Monterey. We'll be back. What are we going to hear about in the second hour here?
Well, you know, I've been investigating estrogen a little bit and its effect on men.
Oh, boy. All right, folks. This is the Dr. Future Show. We'll see you again after the break.
And up next on KSEO, it's hour number two of the Dr. Future Show.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show.
Yes, yes, that was a nice brief little walk down the hall and back during the break.
Yeah, I noticed we had a little article up on the board that talked about the future of AM radio here at KSEO and whether or not the digital age is killing AM radio, which has been an American institution since the 20s. Casey Kasem's Top 40 and all that good stuff. So what's going to happen? Well, I just wanted to say this about the future of radio. The bands will undoubtedly change. In this article, they're talking about moving AM to FM bands using translators, FM translators. I think that's a transitional technology, but what I can see, the writing was on the wall when I was able to use my iPhone and plug it into the input, the aux in on the car. At that point, I mean, it's a fait accompli. Literally, I have thousands of stations at my fingertips and other services like Pandora.
So you're using your cell phone for your radio.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. We have a 2012 Honda Accord, and it is a fairly primitive. It doesn't interface with the iPhone as well as I'd like it to. You can't play music directly. You have to use the aux. It doesn't use the Bluetooth in a compatible way. But I think that's going to come. I think the next couple generations of Bluetooth will allow you to use Bluetooth from anything on your phone or your iPad or Kindle. It'll work if it has Bluetooth.
And so the plan for the transition of AM radio to FM involves continuing to broadcast on AM, but then allowing that signal to be picked up by FM transmitters so people can just listen on their FM dial.
Right, right.
And so it's two kinds of radio compressed into one.
FM doesn't have as much static.
Right.
And it doesn't skip like AM radio does.
FM is a closer signal, right? It doesn't go as far.
Right, right. AM is the kind of radio that in a solar max, where there's lots of sunspot activity, you can pick up, say, KSEO in Philadelphia.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, there'll be strange skips of the signal through the ionosphere.
Uh-huh.
Which is kind of fun.
Fascinating.
Really. And you don't quite have that with the digital world.
Right.
And speaking of which, we're supposed to be at a solar maximum right now.
Okay.
It's just an 11-year cycle where solar sunspot activity and solar flares and winds increase over an 11-year cycle, and we're at the peak of it now. And the sun has been mysteriously quiet just when the activity should be its highest.
So much for scientific predictions.
Yeah. Yeah, and this weekend was really the height of this 11-year cycle. It's not unprecedented fully, but it's odd considering where we are in the cycle. The solar cycle right now is pretty benign, even though we're at the peak. And what could this mean?
What could it mean, Dr. Future? Do you have any insights about this? Is the sun speaking to you directly?
There's science, my dear, and there's shamanism. Those are two different worlds.
Absolutely.
Not that they can't be combined, but they're two different worlds.
So the scientists were all expecting there to be unprecedented solar storms going on right now, interfering with all kinds of invisible frequencies from radio to gamma rays to any kind of frequency that you can attribute to the sun. And instead, nothing's happening.
Well, I wouldn't say nothing. Nothing happened, we'd be dead. But
nothing unusual is happening.
Yeah, high solar activity.
Right.
Usually we have much higher numbers of sunspots. We have more energetic bursts like flares, like coronal mass ejections. They're at a high peak right now. We're sort of ducking these coronal ejections that are heading towards us that could knock out our satellites.
We've been very lucky in the last few years of the increasing solar cycle. All of the giant, unprecedented solar mass ejections have missed us. They haven't come towards planet Earth. They've gone towards other parts of the solar system.
Yeah, it's like a giant cosmic Russian roulette. We've been lucky so far.
Unless maybe the solar intelligence knows not to aim at the planets, Maybe there's a sentient relationship there.
Hey, you're getting shamanic on me, man. That's probably more likely.
I'm that kind of scientist. I think it's all alive.
It's all a feedback loop. It's all alive in one way or another, depending on how you define life. So, yeah, I mean, those are the unknowns. We don't really think of barely the Earth as a sentient organism, never mind the solar system.
Right.
I think the first time I ran into that idea was in Mary Poppins.
What?
Believe it or not, yeah, it was like a plant of a shamanic idea in a child's story. What I remember, it was about a baby in the window, you know, the sun shining on the baby and the sun talking to the baby.
In Mary Poppins,
yeah, Mary Poppins. That's about all I remember from my
fourth
grade.
I guess we're about due for watching that movie again.
Yeah. No, that wasn't a movie. That was in the book. That was in the book.
Oh, it was in the book.
Yeah.
Oh, I haven't read the book.
So thinking of other things as being intelligent is not a new idea, but we tend to be species-centric. We mostly just think of ourselves as intelligent, mm-hmm. nothing else. And that's couldn't be further from the truth on when you really get into understanding communications and what's possible mm-hmm. with other species. But we haven't been educated in that too much yet.
Too much.
That's why E.L. Wilson wants us to have the Encyclopedia of Life to look at so we can begin to see that we're part of millions of species and it's an interpenetrating grid of intelligence that's really quite profound and it's really happening all the time and we're part of it and we can solve all our problems from dipping into that awareness. And that's, you know, part of what's unfolding. So for some reason, the sun right now is very low in its solar activity. I suppose we could go ask it. Should we go outside?
No, I'm content to just take it from the internet.
Any speculation out there as to why the solar activity is so low and it should be so high? It is a mystery.
Yes, it does not exactly make the news headlines most of the time.
Yeah. Well, maybe Art
Unless
Bell will cover it.
Unless there's a crisis.
Yeah, maybe Art will cover it. You heard about Art Bell coming back.
Oh, tell us about Art Bell coming back. That was our original introduction to radio, really, is that we were big fans of the Art Bell show for many, many years.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Art was a blast to listen to. I love the way he was experimenting with video in the early days, too.
Really?
Yeah. He had live webcams on.
That's right. He was a radio broadcaster with his own live webcam. I forgot. It was a little boring, but at least it was innovative.
But he's a radio guy. He's not used to thinking of sets and design and blue screens and keeping people entertained visually. Okay. No. It's in the voice.
That's right.
So he's a late night show called Dark Matter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is our connection at Kurzweil, Amara Angelica, that Art Bell launched last night a new nightly radio show called Dark Matter. And he had Michio Kaku on. Michio Kaku has a new book out. He's on Sirius XM Indie Talk Channel 104.
Okay. So you have to go online to listen to it?
You subscribe to Sirius XM. Now, I believe we have that on Dish. I think if you have Dish, maybe DirecTV, some cable subscriptions, they'll give you Sirius XM. They have an XM app for Android and iOS. So as long as you can access Sirius XM, you can listen to Art.
Okay, but Sirius XM usually is a subscription radio service. So don't expect to just find it on your average radio dial.
No, not on the AM or the FM bands.
Right.
Unless it's pirate FM radio or something, but probably not.
Okay.
Okay.
Great.
Now, for those who don't know, Art was the founder and original host of Coast to Coast AM.
Which, for many years, was aired as the late night programming here on KSEO.
Right.
And now it has been replaced by Coast to Coast with George Norrie for the last 10 years or so.
And George has a different personality than Art.
Right.
He's less of a scientific, more of a new age kind of guy. Each has their own followings. They're slightly different.
Yeah.
So it shows you, once again, the cult of personality is what we pay attention to.
Right. Yes, but Art Bell was well known for exploring mm-hmm. all of the military aspects of the UFO cult, and he was very into alternative groups such as, say, vampire communities or things like that. He was really into weird, fascinating people.
Yes.
And he lived in Pioche, Nevada back then. He doesn't anymore, but he was just a half hour away from Las Vegas, so you can imagine the kinds of people who would come to his show.
Perump, wasn't it?
Perump, right.
Yeah, Perump.
On the middle of the desert.
Exactly. Yeah. So he's back. And watch out.
Yay. Well, that should be fun. I look forward. I'll try and tune in.
Good one. Now, one of the things we have gotten some questions about is that this new Touch ID sensor on the iPhone.
Right. A lot of people are relieved that finally we're going to be able to stop having to remember so many passwords all the time, because the device will just know who we are from our fingerprints.
Yeah. And some people have been asked about, well, what's to stop you from chopping off the finger of someone else and using that finger to get into their data?
A natural, gross
a
question
natural thing that
for people who watch all these
yes.
crime drama shows.
No problem. It's really good. Yeah, we love this. But it would not work with the Apple sensor.
Okay. So all of us Apple users, we can feel safe. No one is going to be cutting off our fingers to get into our iPhones.
Yes. The iPhone 5S uses two methods to sense and identify your fingerprint.
Okay.
Okay. One is capacitive and the other is radio frequency.
Please explain.
A capacitive sensor, it's activated by a slight electrical charge running through your skin. We all have small amounts of electrical current going through our bodies. And, you know, touch screens use this capacitive technology so that they work. So that small electrical current allows touch screens to work. Radio frequencies waves don't respond to the dead layer of skin on the outside of your finger, the part that might be chapped or too dried or be read with much accuracy. And so what radio frequency does is that it reads only the living tissue underneath. And this makes a very precise image of your print. And it ensures that a severed finger is completely useless.
And a smudged, it seems like it would be harder to smudge.
Yes, be harder to smudge. But it is extremely accurate for living creatures. So only fingers attached to a beating heart will be able to unlock it. That's the important thing about it. For more details on this, we have an article. You can read about this. But once tissue is dead, like when somebody chops your finger off without your consent, two things happen. First, the finger loses all electrical charge and will fail to even activate the sensor because it loses electrical charge. And secondly, if it could be artificially activated, the RF reader that's searching for the print will find no living tissue and fail for that reason and leave it locked. But if you really want to hack it, if it's some miracle the person snatching your finger had a compatible human host waiting for your finger to be transplanted onto their body, and if they managed to complete that procedure before the tissue died, then you might have cause for concern.
All right.